Welcome to episode 12 of All of Your Business. These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of business owners whose currents raise tides that lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. Before we get started, we are proud to announce that All of Your Business podcast has received a 2020 X-Ray Podcast Award presented by X-Ray FM. X-Ray FM, purpose-driven media at 91.1 FM and 107.1 FM, and find them online at xray.fm. Today's episode is brought to you by Iron Tap Station. 33 taps, nothing but craft. On this episode, we're speaking with Srinivasa Brown of Camp Elso. Camp Elso is a multicultural approach to STEAM education rooted in environmental justice and cultural history. And now, executive producer and host, Michael Jonas.
We're at a Tribe Called Sweat at JJT Studios. Great place. So thank you for having us. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to have you on the show to talk to you about Camp Elso, because I think it's beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I'm really proud of you and all the work you're doing. Can you talk to us about Camp Elso and tell listeners what this beautiful thing that you've made is?
Yeah. So I'm Srinivasa Brown. Go by Sprina, use she, her pronouns. And Camp Elso, Elso stands for Experience Life Science Outdoors. And we are a education nonprofit that uses the natural world to connect children with science. Our long-term vision is that Black and brown kids will see themselves in science, see themselves represented in science, and want to go into those career fields. So we hope that by the programs that we're creating, that it will inspire them, that they'll have opportunities to learn from folks who look like them and to learn science in a way that is decolonized. I'm hoping we'll talk more about what I mean by that. And that just brings in a cultural perspective and cultural history, because that's been a big piece of what's missing in science education and missing in education overall, is just the different cultural perspectives. And so Elso's really about having students bring their whole identity into a learning environment and into a space that's designed to support them on their career track.
Yeah. Well, that sounds great.
Thank you.
And I know that it has to do with STEM. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Mm-hmm. And I've also seen STEAM.
Yeah.
And I think that might be adding arts and humanities into the mix. So
yeah, we go back and forth.
Can you talk a little bit about STEM and STEAM?
Yeah. So STEM is science, technology, engineering, mathematics. We also sometimes will use the E interchangeably for environment as well. And the A is the arts piece. And so we use different mediums of art. So we've had within our summer camp program, our Wayfinders program, which is what we're most known for, we have brought in and worked with visiting artists who are musicians. Ethnomusicology was one of the things that we melded together with biomimicry, so that the kids could learn about biomimicry through the perspective of music. And so during that particular session, the kids learned about how musical instruments were inspired by nature and what they looked like in their rawest form, like a conch shell that can be used to make some deep tonal sounds, and how that might have influenced drums, or how gourds are a part of the Birnenbau, and how that's part of like culture. So, and how those different things came from or were inspired by nature, or mimicking nature, biomimicry.
That's really cool stuff.
Yeah.
So what is your background? I mean, do you have a history of either music or science or nature? How did you come to form this nonprofit that kind of embodies all those things?
There's definitely a lot of me and my backgrounds in Elso. I have an undergraduate degree in biology and African American studies. So just learning my own history and history of Black people was a really important part of my experience in school, and important because there was like a in high school and below, it just was missing. And then in college, it was something that I yearned for, which is why I ended up going into that field. And so bringing those things into ELSA was really important. So science, biology, I don't have a background in music so much as I do dance, and just knowing that art is how a lot of Black and brown people, music, it's just part of our culture, is a part of who we are. So just thinking about what are those different things that's a part of Black identity, identity of people of color that we can bring in. So, and how can that be like an intentional part of the curriculum and experience we're creating?
Well, thank you. You talked a little bit about earlier colonization. And I don't need to tell you twice, you know, we have systematic racism and oppression in so many ways, and have had that for years. You know, we're in the middle of a racial crisis and racial issues, but these issues have gone on forever. And then some of the things we see are just the things we see that are actually filmed. You know, everything else that exists, whether it's police violence or brutality or even a microaggression, those are things that are not filmed. So I guess, can you talk a little bit about that, like how the education helps with the systematic oppression, potentially giving these kids a voice, knowing that they're heard and that they're important?
I know that's a lot
to unpack in one.
I can unpack that. I could take some time. So part of when we started ELSO, myself and our other co-founder Kellyanne, we're approaching it from the sense that we wanted to get more kids of color who looked like us to learn from adults who look like them. And we landed on this camp model as being a great way to get kids engaged in learning, get them outside and do things that were hands-on. What we realized, what we quickly came to realize and have learned over the last 4 years is science itself, how it's taught, what's considered science, who's considered a scientist, it all comes back to Western understandings of science and the dominant culture. And so we realized that if we're going to inspire more kids to see themselves as scientists, we really have to start questioning and redefining what we mean by science, and that science can be learned from anywhere and from anyone, that your parents are your first educators. So in theory, they're also your first science teachers. We knew that science could be taught outside, even though the norm is to engage with science in a classroom or in a lab space, it really is not the way that most people learn things. Like, we learn things by doing. And so we wanted to redefine science in a way that allowed for more cultural perspectives. But basically, we were thinking a lot about what it means to decolonize science and what are the systems and structures in place that prevent kids from seeing themselves in the field. And so I'll come back to that thought. I lost my whole train of thought.
So it sounds like part of that is the educational component.
Yeah.
Part of it is the representation. And then it seems also like there's some belief, there's some confidence formed of you can do this, you can be that, you can be that teacher, that scientist, that doctor, whatever you want to be. It sounds like that's kind of also a component of this and these programs.
Yeah, definitely. Those are all intentional pieces. And so our summer program is an affinity space for Black and brown youth. So all of the kids who participate identify as Black, Indigenous, or person of color. And they are in kindergarten through eighth grade, so they come from schools and communities across the metro area. And then we take them on these different outdoor experiences. And so we're trying to expose them to different ways of understanding the same thing. So let's say research, for instance. We talk a lot about what does research look in the, like in the context of healthcare? What are the ethics that guide research? How does that impact people? So I think part of what decolonizing science includes is remembering to ask the question of how does this impact people and who is impacted? So bringing in that lens of racial justice and equity, to look at problems that are systems and problems like environmental issues or science systems. Like, we know that Black and Brown folks were often the guinea pigs, so to speak, or test subjects for medicines and drugs and things that are now on the market. So when we talk about research, we talk about testing on animals. We also talk about the testing and ethics on people and who gets to decide what's okay and what's not okay to do. Then we also take research and take it out of the context of healthcare and put it in the context of culture. And how do people who are not using, let's say, technology, who are coming from a cultural perspective, perhaps it's indigenous tribes, how are they looking at the health of their community? How are they looking at the health of fish, of their land? What are the research practices or methods that they're engaging that are from a cultural perspective that we might not even know that they're doing or know that it exists because we've only understood research from this dominant culture way? And so part of what we are trying to do with our approach is to really name the lens in which we're teaching. So are we teaching from a dominant culture perspective, or are we teaching from a cultural perspective? And why are we presenting this information in that way? So really asking the how and the why, and then taking a step back and saying, okay, now that we know, what's the balance here, and how do we find balance so that kids can start to see, okay, I'm understanding research from Western culture, I'm understanding it from these cultural perspectives, I know how to navigate back and forth between the two so that I can come up with some solutions to some, you know, just to our problems that we face.
Sure.
Yeah.
And you may agree, you know, textbooks aren't what they should be, right? So.
Yeah.
You know, there's books where it's a sentence or two about slavery and they make it act like the slave had a choice or, you know, there's something about, an invention for farming and it was actually a Black person who, you know, did the plow or did whatever. So how do we make it so that that education, the, you know, the learning that's done in schools also matches the experiential type learning, the learning we have in nature?
Yeah. Oh, that's a good question. So we've actually been asking that question just since this past January as part of our bigger conversation around, like, where do we go from here? And, like, what's our long-term objective with ELSO? Because we've been doing these summer programs and youth development programs for 4 years now or 5 years. And we are doing great programming, but it's not necessarily system level change. So we started asking ourselves, like, what is going to be our system level impact? And if we know we want to get more kids of color into STEM fields, we realize that we really need to have a plan for how we're addressing what is taught in the classroom and in the science classroom. And so so far, we've noticed a few things that, by and large, most textbooks, science reference materials, all of those are from a Western perspective and really lack representation of folks of color, Black, Indigenous, Brown people in how it's being taught and then the stories and narratives that are also presented. And so we realized that what we need to do is develop our own curriculum, like take what we've learned in doing Wayfinders and adapt it so that teachers can take it into the classroom. So we are in the process of developing a science curriculum that is student-centered and that's designed with Black and Brown students as the focus. So really looking at who are the most under-resourced, most marginalized students in the classroom, and how can we create this curriculum to reach them, knowing that everybody else in the classroom will benefit just from really focusing on those unmet needs of the kids who are most marginalized in their experience. And so what we're hoping to do is to bring in some stories and narratives that have not been told. So whether it's in chemistry or biology, microbiology, physics, whatever the topics are, really looking at, like, what are those key things that kids need to know? We know that there are certain skill sets that they need to develop as scientists, to succeed as scientists, but the how we teach them that information is what's key. And it can make or break whether or not they say, oh, like, I love this. Like, mm-hmm. this speaks to me. It speaks to my lived experience. Like, I get this. I can talk to my family about this. I can see this in my neighborhood. It's relevant for me. That's how science should be. And so that's what we're trying to do now is we're building a team. In fact, it's been a big shift in how we think about our work and just what we've been doing this summer, just in the midst of COVID and everything. Mm-hmm. Like I said, we started thinking about this in January and identified, like, okay, we know we want to put out a science curriculum, mm-hmm. but how do we go about doing it? And what is the team that we need to build? And so right now we're working on building a core planning team of people like teachers who are Black and Brown teachers. Mm-hmm. So actually creating opportunity for those teachers who are in the minority of a minority, sure. to kind of step into this role to create and to advise curriculum development and instructional design, because that's the other piece of it, is it's what it's being taught, but also like how it's being taught as well.
Yeah, and that's one of the really beautiful things about the nonprofit is, you know, people of color are helping to teach and create programs for other people of color.
Yeah.
We often have this problem in society where, I mean, I'll just say it, white people mm-hmm. act as if they know what yeah. people of color need
mm-hmm.
versus
mm-hmm.
asking them, involving mm-hmm. them, giving a voice at the table.
Yeah.
So, you know, that yeah. has to change
mm-hmm.
because we don't know what other people need.
Mm-hmm.
We
mm-hmm.
have to involve them in that process.
Yeah, definitely. And the perspectives that come out of that by giving people a voice and the power to say for themselves, this is what my community needs, and then to just provide them the resources to get it, that I think is what's really going to be pivotal in starting to deconstruct our systems of, you know, oppression and what's been preventing Black and Brown people from realizing their full potential is by creating opportunities for them to say, hey, this is what education should sure. look like. And empowering parents to be able to advocate for themselves. And mm-hmm. and the tricky part, though, is that not all of our communities have the resources or the information to be able to articulate that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where I think it's really important for organizations like ELSO to really have those good and close community ties and ties with families and ties with schools and educators and all of that, but to be able to come to the table and say, hey, this is what we're hearing. Like we yeah. hear like this from parents, this is what that translates to into in terms of resources and support and curriculum so that their kids can thrive in
school. Yeah, and it's good that you're realizing there's that multifaceted nature. There's yeah. the educational component from reading, there's the actual learning and seeing and doing, but then there's also the people who are involved and mm-hmm. the teaching that goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was going to talk about is, you know, we have these kind of Hollywood gems like Hidden Figures and mm-hmm. things like that, and they're beautiful films, mm-hmm. but it shouldn't take a Hollywood film to talk about those things.
Yeah.
And it's sort yeah. of like you shouldn't have to wait mm-hmm. for a Harriet Tubman movie to know about Harriet Tubman.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
and we sort of have these cute little descriptions mm-hmm. of these folks, but mm-hmm. we don't really know what their background is.
Mm-hmm.
There's also stories that we don't know. You know, yeah. I just read about Yosemite mm-hmm. National Park and mm-hmm. how there were Black people who protected Yosemite
yes.
so that it wasn't destroyed or ruined.
Yeah. The Buffalo Soldiers.
Yeah, the Buffalo
yeah.
Soldiers.
That's
yeah.
one of my favorite stories to share with kids because we don't know that. And it's what's ironic is that people who work in the Forest Service don't even know that. And so there's missing pieces of history and information that hasn't been shared. And you're right. Like if we wait for these movies, these blockbusters to tell our stories, one, it's not telling the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's missing so many rich stories. Like we took a group of kids out last year to Silver Falls. We were working with a local auxiliary group of a local sorority, and we took them out there to take them on a hike, and we were telling them about the Buffalo Soldiers, who were some of the first park rangers, and just to see the sense of pride that comes, like you can see it in people's faces and eyes when they start to say, oh, like we've been doing this nature thing. Like it's not just for white folks. And to know that is so empowering. I've been reading this book called Rooted in the Earth, I believe, the African American Environmental Heritage by Deanne Glain. Might have to fact check that. might not be accurate, but it's a very short book. It's maybe a half an inch thick. Mm-hmm. And I can only read it two pages at a time because it's that rich with information about folks in, like, Black people who were seafarers, because we hear about the Middle Passage. We know the story struggle. Like, the story struggle is in all across Hollywood. Everybody knows the story struggle. But we don't know the stories of people who were seafaring, who were free, mm-hmm. and who navigated by the stars, and who had a positive and empowering relationship with the ocean. Sure. And so Black folks, by and large, have this this narrative and this history, this one-sided history that, oh, the ocean, we fear, you know, we have this deep-seated fear of water because of historical traumas. But we don't know that we actually went to the ocean for freedom, too, and that we navigated the seas, and that there was women like Nancy Price who navigated the seas and were a part of the whole transatlantic slave trade movement, whatever you want to call it. Like, those stories are just not there. Yeah. And so I'm reading this book and I'm underlining and circling every page because I'm like, there's a story here, there's a lesson here, there's curriculum here. And it's just this one small tiny text that it just makes me think that how many more stories and how much more of our history are we missing, mm-hmm. that kids of our future generations need to know, yeah. so that they can start to challenge and break down these narratives that Black folks don't belong outside, mm-hmm. we don't do outdoors, we don't swim, like all this stuff that is not true, but has been a part of our history, our experiences. So it's there for a reason, but it's time for us to start like shifting that.
Yeah, and you raise mm-hmm. a good point about those stories. I think everybody should know them,
yeah,
regardless of race. Mm-hmm. Because, for example, you know, it's 100 years of suffrage,
mm-hmm.
and people don't realize that, you know, people don't know who Ida B. Wells is. Yeah. People don't realize that Black people, even though they knew that they may not be able to vote, mm-hmm. the Black women still fought
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
for women to vote.
Yeah.
And I mean, that is the ultimate, yeah. you know, altruistic thing to do,
yeah.
and sacrifice. So, mm-hmm. I mean, not that I'm saying white women should thank Black women. I mean, mm-hmm. they should for other reasons. But
they should.
The point, yeah, they should. But the point is we have these cute whitewashed, as you were saying, yes. or westernized stories
mm-hmm.
that are devoid of actual people who are involved in them, mm-hmm. or actually don't tell the full story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that doesn't do justice for mm-hmm. any child.
Yep. And it's like, if we only highlight this one person, like everybody knows Harriet Tubman and Martin Luther King, and it's like those are great, but for all kids and for all people, if you don't see yourself in them, then you'll just think that that's the only person that did it, and their contribution was what am I trying to say? It was not the norm, or something was special about
sure.
them.
You have to reach yeah. you know, godly proportions
yeah.
in order to be special,
mm-hmm.
or to feel like you're enough, and mm-hmm. that's just not true,
or to contribute to a movement. And so, like, all of these, there's so many people who were pivotal in the suffrage movement and things, and worked side by side together. And I think we know it because we see it now, like with the protests since George Floyd's murder, we see that it takes calculated efforts of people on the front lines protesting, people behind, like, there's mm-hmm. you have to have a multi-layered approach. But when we look back at history, we don't question that yeah. the narratives we hear are only of those, that one spokesperson, that one figurehead.
Well, even with, you know, Selma,
yeah,
I think a lot of people thought, oh, it's just Black people walking, mm-hmm. and that's so contrary from the truth. I mean, mm-hmm. it was all kinds of people hand
yep.
in hand.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't know why. I mean, I know why, but
yeah.
I don't know why the, you know, history has to be like that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like fixing education to make it appear more accurate, you can still have the full effect.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to tell these lies. You don't have to keep things out. But what I wanted to talk to you about is whether it's with George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter protester movement, or whether it's with having that, you know, Black mother talk to your child, right?
Yeah.
Like, how do you balance, because this is something I've been trying to understand with Black mothers, like, how do you balance educating with not giving them so much fear and worry, because it's heavy stuff. So where is that balance for our youth? How do we sort of meander through that? And then also, I know I'm asking you like four questions at once, but also how do you approach racism with kids who maybe either don't get it, or maybe they have only heard what their parents say, or what TV has said, or what the horrible president has said, or as I call Don the Con.
Okay, for your first question.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah. I'm like, that's a heavy question. For when it comes to me personally and what my family has done, we've always been about Black empowerment and trying to raise kids that are fully aware of their Blackness and understand both like the history of our people from what they're going to face when they leave our house and when they step out into the world, but also like supplementing what they're going to learn and experience with like other knowledge. And so I don't know if there's ever a balance. I think things are always shifting in and out of balance. This last year has, just since this spring, has been extremely difficult. I think I've gotten to a place where I can take care of myself first as a Black woman, mother, leader, and separate my personal experience from what I'm, how I'm trying to raise and what I'm trying to do for my kids to make sure that they have the space to have a childhood without the stresses of oppression, like race-related oppression, and the tiredness and the heaviness that comes from that, by really just watching how much I'm sharing and trying to check my own emotions so that I can share information, and then also like really calling out like, this is how I feel about this, and giving them the facts and letting them decide. So I have a 9-year-old son going into fourth grade, and I have a 4-year-old daughter. My 4-year-old daughter, our conversations are pretty light. We still focus a lot on like hair, you know, making sure that she has lots of representation in her books and things that she sees, and really watching her friendships.
When you said that, I thought of that short video, that hair video.
The short hair video.
There's a short hair video. It's a cartoon. You have to see it.
Oh, check it out.
Janita shook her head. Yes.
Yeah. So we just, I just try to, uplift her and just share with her and teach her about like Black girl magic. Like that's the focus for her, is just teaching her that her skin is beautiful and that your hair is kinky and curly and it's thick, and this is what you need for your skin and for your body. Empowering her with information so that she can take care of herself. And I think that's where, not take care of herself, but tend to what she needs and have a positive self-image. So that's what I'm doing with my daughter, and just watching her friendships and making sure that she's in spaces where she's not the only Black girl. With my son, he's aware of everything. Like he's very aware of everything. And so with him, I try not to shelter him from a lot of information, but I also try to be, I don't know. I just,
does he know, you know, not just George Floyd, but like Ahmaud Arbery and Tamir Rice? And I mean, I can go on, as you know, but you know, Breonna Taylor, does he know their names, their stories, or ever ask, ever ask you like, Mom, you know, what happened here?
He hasn't asked that. I think he's more caught up in video games and little things that little boys are. But I took him to the protest for Mike Brown when he was younger, and we taught him about what does justice mean? What are we fighting for? Why are people marching? And then he asked to go to some of the marches for George Floyd and for the Black Lives Matter movement. And so he was very into it. It was really uncomfortable for me because we took him to a march that was for kids, and I would share with you this story because I still cringe when I think about it. We went to this march that was locally hosted, and it was designed for kids, and it was predominantly white community members. I kind of expected that, but wasn't sure. Like, it's Portland, so you never know who's gonna show up and come out. He was really excited. So they're walking, we're walking, and it's through a neighborhood, mind you. Mm-hmm. And he's shouting, like, Black Lives Matter. And then they started saying, the person up front who was leading, who had the mic, was Black. That person started saying, I can't breathe. And everybody around us started saying it. And I look at my son, and he's really into it. And so, like, we're still there. But hearing white folks say, I can't breathe, sure, was very uncomfortable. And my husband and I were both like, this is not how this should be.
Yeah.
And so we asked him, we're like, are you sure you still want to be here? Because me and my husband, we were ready to go. We were like, this is enough. Like, we've crossed that threshold where this feels performative, and we feel like people are not fully understanding what they're saying, and repeating things that are really painful. But my son was like, no, I want to stay here. So we were like, okay, like, this is for you. And so he is there with his sister, and his sister, they were marching.
When you raise a good point, because I often see that there's we keep railing on Karens, but you know, there's like the white woman who thinks she's a progressive ally and does everything wrong. There are white people who do what you were saying, performative. You know, and then during that time there were even people who were there were some politicians who were putting on a mask at rallies, and they were saying, I can't breathe, and laughing about it because they're putting on a COVID mask. And I'm like, that's not funny at all. I guess my question for you in that, and I'm asking you all the tough questions, it is, you know, how do you separate the two? How do we know who is for real and maybe not perfect, needs to grow, and then who is really not doing it for the right reasons? You know, how do
that's
we,
because
I struggle with that, knowing who's for real and who's kind of, and I struggle with that not just in racist ways, but you know, I have a boyfriend, and for the pinking or gang of things, or environmentalism, you know, ExxonMobil tries to tell me they're a green company, and I'm like, I'm not having that. So I mean, how do we with race figure out who is real, even if they're not perfect, they're kind of on that way, and they really do want to learn and grow from the people who are kind of just taking advantage of, I'm gonna make money off Black people.
So I think of it at one, it's not black and white, and I think we have to think of it as a journey towards racial justice, or towards self-awareness and consciousness of what my lived experience is and what others' lived experience are. So with that said, being able to recognize first where you are personally on that journey. So I'm very aware, because I do this work and engage in it regularly, where my biases are and where I have blind spots and where my learning edge is. And I'm constantly putting myself in situations where I can learn more from people who can speak from that I perspective, so that I can understand. When it comes to looking at folks who are wishing to be allies and evaluating ally efforts, one, I look at people's social media, especially recently. I've gone through all my white friends, and I'll look and I'll be like, oh, well, what did you post? Have you said anything?
Yeah.
And if you posted a black box and nothing else, then I'm just like, okay, like, that's a step, but maybe you're not fully understanding.
Or the white argument that they're not privileged. That's a favorite.
And then I look at people who are not posting anything on their social media, but maybe they're doing something behind the scenes. So I think you have to look at, like, money. Where are you putting your resources? Where do people put their resources? Community. Do you actually have people within your circle who don't look like you? Do you know transgender people? Do you know Black people? And are they your friends, like real friends? Like, are you inviting them over? Can they drop over at your house?
Or not, are just they just like that, not just that lady that works at the store that she sometimes go to?
Yeah, or like you have a neighbor that is nice to you because you live in the same neighborhood, but they don't probably really don't consider you an actual friend. And I don't think most white people quite know the difference. And then there's like, so when I say money, community, and what are your conversations like with your relatives? If you feel uncomfortable talking to another white person, you can't talk to your brother or your colleague or somebody else, don't even come talk to me. Like, we're just, let's not even consider ourselves friends. Because if you can't do that uncomfortable thing of having that conversation, but you want to be good friends with me and tell me how much you love Obama and voted for him and you're doing this, but you can't even have a hard conversation.
Well, you know, and there are people that are racist and, you know, they love basketball and Beyonce, but they don't really like Black people.
And don't really want to engage with an actual Black person.
But that is a good point, though, that we're in a time where even being racist is not enough. I mean, you have to be racist, but you also can't just say, oh, I'm not racist.
Yeah.
You have to show that in your actions and your words and the way you live your life. And you have to speak up. And sometimes it's giving people, you know, a voice and letting them talk. And that was kind of what we touched on earlier, is a lot of people, they want to do that, but they instead will say, oh, this is what she wants. How about she comes here and talks, and that may be the way that we find out what she wants. So I think a lot of times we're doing that with Black people, is we're sort of prescribing for them what they need and not listening to them and not
believing them when they say, like, this is what it is, or this is what my experience is. Just like believing them, even when it's uncomfortable, and then doing whatever they say. Like, I think that signs of a good ally is someone who is stepping back from whatever their mic is, whether it's a community platform or at home, at work, whatever it is, like stepping back to say, this is like letting a Black person, letting a brown person speak and just hearing their voice, and then finding out from them how can I support you, and being able to share, this is what I'm doing on my own journey. Like, I back to what I was saying about my son, I ask people that, like, any of his friends, I want to know, like, where are you putting your time and money and resources? Like, how are you talking about race and whiteness and privilege? That's a big thing in our family. How are you talking about privilege with your kids? If you know you guys have a lot of privilege and you're not even comfortable talking about it, then we can't even get to a place of talking about race, because if you can't even acknowledge the fact that you have other types of privilege.
And I think you know, a lot of people don't even understand or take the time to think about that. You know, like, when you're driving, do you have to worry that if a police officer stops you, what's gonna happen? When you go into a Walgreens, is someone following you? I mean, there's things that we just don't experience and don't care to think are true or believe, but they surely are true, and they surely do happen, and imagine how that would make you feel. I mean, if someone were to follow you. So I don't think sometimes that people believe think people believe Black people, like what you were saying, like, oh, like, you have
like
a good
life,
like
in the day-to-day, like really believing just like the small things.
They think, oh, you have a good life, you have opportunity just like me. It's there's so much more to it, that every day, everything you're doing, you know, you have to think about that. Education access, getting a job, representation, being ignored when you're giving ideas, like, it just goes, the list goes on and on and on.
And I think too, when we start thinking about that list, it's exhausting. And I talk about it with folks all the time. It's very easy for white folks to get exhausted thinking about and talking about racism. And I think that's often the aha moment that they have when they're like, oh, so if I was Black, this is what it would feel like. And so I think for the most part, going through my day-to-day experience, I'm not always thinking about things from a racialized lens, but if a problem comes up, it's just ingrained in me to wonder, like, would this have been this way if I was not a woman, if I was not Black? Like, how would this have been different? And when you see a situation unfold, you, as a Black person, you notice things that white people have to train their eyes to notice. And I think it's that, it's being in that place of constantly training your mind to remember, to acknowledge, and to see things from a different perspective. That's when people are being practicing good allyship and remembering that, okay, I'm never going to notice this or see it, but if I'm training myself and developing my stamina for seeing racism and a lived experience, then that's when you start to realize, okay, this is how it's just around us. It's all around us.
Yeah. And do you think that this time is different? You know, we keep hearing that, whether that's a cute thing to say or not. And the other thing is people are sensationalizing John Lewis, which he should be sensationalized. But John Lewis is one of the people who we should have known, who should have been in history books for kids, which is another one of those, you know, why don't we already know these people, whether they're local heroes or national heroes? But one of the things about John Lewis is even before his death, I mean, he was marching in the Black Lives Matter movement, and he saw all the different faces, all different races that were there. And I believe he felt that it was somewhat different. So how do you sort of not get apathetic and like, oh, whatever, you know, or and combine that with hope and forward moving, you know, this is different. We can make these changes. And these changes, as you know, I mean, there's so many things. Like, again, exhausting. We have to change prisons and sentencing reform. We have to change education. We have to change
healthcare,
great teachers who can't even afford supplies. Like, it goes on and on and on. So how do you, I guess my question for you is, how do you believe every day? Because what you're doing requires that belief as well. How do you believe that things do get better and it is worth getting out of bed and fighting for those changes?
You know, I don't know that I believe that things will get better. I think that I've accepted that part of what I'm willing, like, I've accepted that whether things are going to improve or not, a time period that I'm going to be on this earth, I don't know what the level of improvement is going to be. But I know that while I'm here, I would like to be doing something positive towards it. And so in terms of apathy, you cycle in and out of it. And I think you have to have, and that's why it's really important to have people around you who can support you and have that community, especially as a Black person who's leading an organization. Like, the mental exhaustion, the emotional exhaustion, physical exhaustion from having to work within community and also address the systemic racism that's in the nonprofit field and philanthropy and all that, just as a leader, is always there. And so, like, I cycle in and out of places of feeling hopeless and hopeful, of being able to push hard and needing to take a step back to regroup. And I think that's part of why, and it's a buzzword, but why self-care is so important. And when you're doing it the right way, you're doing it in a way where you can go hard for a period of time and then take a step back, rejuvenate, get recentered, ground yourself, and then come back into the fight. And knowing that, like, I always have this knowledge that I'm not the only one that's doing this. And as long as we are constantly pushing for change, that change will come and it will be incremental. And so I really do, so I don't know if that's a hopeless outset to begin with, but I struggle with whether or not we can really change things in this country. Because our country is founded on and, like, built on the back of enslaved people. Like, our systems and structures are built this way. So to try and shift what's inherently flawed, I don't know if that's the best approach. And I don't know if as a country we can rebuild from the ground up, because it's going to take enough of us saying that the system is broken and all those different systems that you named to be able to rebuild them.
The other part of it that is exhausting is Black people are often expected to explain or teach to white people, whereas it's not their responsibility. I mean, it is a white person's responsibility to figure out, you know, what their privilege is, to understand the history of America. And I think that a lot of times Black people feel that burden that white people continuously ask them, you know, what is your history? What is it like to be Black? Like, that is an additional added weight that you have on your shoulders.
And it's personal and professional. Like, it's like in your neighborhood community with neighbor. Like, I have neighbors that want to talk about stuff, and I'm like, I don't want to talk about the Black Lives Matter sign that you made and put on your garage door. I want to be in my neighborhood and just be with my family and be at peace. And then it's like in a work environment too. And so I think that's that double layer of always having to teach and instruct.
Well, and just being, I think, is something that is what you want, what everybody wants and deserves.
Just to be. Just to be. Not have to think about it, and to just be able to go through life and not be constantly reminded like there are inequitable systems and there's oppression everywhere and there's racism. To just be able to live and to decide like for myself, like I want something for my family and I can go out and get it because I'm afforded the same opportunities. And I think that's what we're working towards, and I feel like that's doable. But I don't think it's going to come from us. It's going to come from some combination of tearing down systems, but really acknowledging that they're inherently flawed and that we really do have to shift dramatically. Like when it comes to policing, I'm definitely pro reform. And I think we need to build a community policing model, which we already have. I mean, the thing about it is, we know the answers. We have the information. This is not new. Just the same as like white folks coming to Black people to ask for information. It's like, it's already out there. All you gotta do is Google it. Like that's that simple now. And you'll get your reading list and take these workshops and take these classes, and you can have the next decade of personal identity development already outlined for you.
Yeah.
But it's people are in such different places on their journey. Like folks who don't know what they don't know, to the I know what I don't know and I still don't want to address it, that until we can get enough people, like enough of the majority, into this place of I now see it, I know it's there, and I'm willing to do something to make myself uncomfortable enough to do something for the betterment of all people in my community, that's when we'll start to really have some change.
And in a real way. And the unfortunate thing is racism has been codified, and it's in science and it's in everything. You know, it's not just one fell swoop or one thing. I agree with you in sense of it's good to have hope, but it's also good to be realistic. I think that's a fair answer. And you know, I do, when I see, you know, when I see the makeup of Congress, like we still have people like Mitch McConnell and the issues with Congress. But when I see, you know, AOC and Ilhan and Ayanna and all these women, and I see, Underwood, I think, Lauren Underwood. Yeah, that's her name. I was going to say Carrie Underwood. That's a country singer. No, Lauren Underwood is also in Congress. You know, I see these like beautiful, strong Black women in Congress. And for me, that gives me hope. And then this particular election, there are more women, people of color, that have ever run.
That's so amazing.
So, so, you know, representation matters not only because those are the people that are going to be helping make the laws, but there's a Black child seeing that person in a power position going, hey, I can do that. I can be that. So I like to think that helps. But it is not just education. It's legislation. It's advocacy. It's businesses. It's all of these things working together. And if people don't like, you know, people are doing this thing where they're saying, like, I don't like the mob mentality, or they call the people who are protesting peacefully a mob, or this isn't pretty, you know, my streets are getting destroyed. Like, neither is oppression. Oppression isn't pretty. So if this is what it takes, is to uncover all of these things and to talk about them and to make them real for people, then that's what it takes.
I agree totally. And I think too, we've got a lot of privilege in this country as Americans, that we don't often see destruction and damage like this. But when you look at world news, like, people are protesting and burning things down and tearing shit up all over this globe the time.
Well, and they seem to be okay with it after after a Lakers game at the Staples Center.
That's true.
Well, and I'm not, you know, pro destruction, but there's a couple people that are there that maybe are doing it. The whole crowd is not. I mean, I was out there with lawyers, nurses, teachers. And people of every race, religion, what they do is what they want to do, whether it's describing immigrants or describing people who are protesting, is they want to make it appear like everyone's out there. Everyone's just has a shaved head. Everyone's a vandal. Everyone's a criminal.
And that it's disorganized and people don't know where they're protesting for. It's like, no, people, I personally think that a lot of people know why they're out there and what they're doing. And I think leave it to law enforcement to go after and to punish and bring to justice those people who are destroying things. Like, it's not for me to judge their actions. We have systems in place for that. But what is for us to do is to look at why they're doing it and what is the system? Like, what? Why are they doing this in the first place? How did we get to this point? And what is it? What is the change that needs to happen so that it can stop?
And we all have a First Amendment right to be out there.
Yep.
To speak without being, you know, tear gassed.
Yeah.
Or shot with bullets or whatever else.
Yeah.
Hit with a baton.
Hit with a baton. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, where they think that's okay is just shocking to me, but it goes on.
Yeah.
In just a moment, we're going to be back with more from Srinivasa Brown of Camp Elso, but we want to take a moment and thank our sponsors. Iron Tap Station, located in Progress Square in Beaverton. Iron Tap is open and appreciates all of its customers' continued support. Head on in for a drink or a meal. All table service and fills are provided with masks and gloves, and they've expanded their outdoor seating. They've got some exciting weekly specials that include To-Go Tuesdays, which feature a single new local can for $2 a can. They also have a rotating $3 pint special every day of the week, so make sure to check them out. Find out more at irontapstation.com. And now back to your host, Michael Jonas, with special guest, Srinivasa Brown.
Well, I just wanted to talk to you on, you know, we've talked about everything, but I kind of wanted to talk to you about COVID and the transition for your nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how, you know, for people listening, some people had to stop the damn word that keeps being used, pivot. We've heard that word so many times.
I know.
Like, what did you have to do for your nonprofit to make it work during these times?
Mm-hmm. So, we had to make a really tough decision back in March, kind of just deciding what we were going to do for this summer. And so my staff went about creating a bunch of different scenarios for different circumstances. So our biggest program, like I mentioned before, is our summer camps. And we have other programs that happen during the school year, after school time, virtually. But it was really like, how are we going to do this Wayfinders program in the midst of COVID? Luckily, it was already designed as an outdoor program. And so because the virus doesn't spread as well outside, we knew if we kept kids outside as much as possible, we could operate it safely. We had to make a hard decision to decide to not use our camp guides, which are high school and college age students that we hire and train, because of the additional risk of that age group and not really knowing where the science is around, like, our high schoolers, our young adults, 18 to 25, more likely to transmit the disease. And, you know, the information is all over the place with that. So we just decided, let's just eliminate that as a risk. And we couldn't train them the way that we needed to in order to have them be our main leaders for the summer. A lot of our sites are closed, a lot of the places that we would normally take kids to, and so we kind of had to redesign a new program and design it as a hybrid camp from scratch. And that's what we did, and I kind of just held my breath and waited to see what would happen. It was nerve-wracking. It was extremely terrifying as a leader to have to make those really tough decisions, but to also, like, now to look back on it and be like, wow, we did that. So we ended up moving to a hybrid model of in-person days of camp, virtual days where the kids were online with our staff and they were at home with their families, and family engagement days where they're just with their families and we've sent home science kits and supplies for them to do. So we decided that we could had capacity, very limited capacity. We could do that for about 26 kids. And then if we reached out to all of our partners and to places that were closed that just had resources sitting in storage cabinets, we could probably get enough things to send home with another 80 families, take home supplies to do science at home. That's and awesome. In their community. So we didn't crunch the numbers quite correctly. We ended up sending home over 560 take-home kits. Wow. Across the metro areas to schools and to partners. So kids in kindergarten through eighth grade were able to start their own garden, to do pH testing and dissolved oxygen testing, catch insects and macroinvertebrates, do veggie dyeing, just all kinds of science stuff. Cool, and it was all free. So we just decided to do all of our programs for free this year. And it went really well, but it was a heavy lift.
Trying to make me cry.
Oh, I mean, it does. It's
that's wonderful
to be as tiny as we are. Like we just got our 501c3 status. I don't think I got a chance to tell you that. Yes. We got our determination letter. But to be this tiny little community-based organization, that has ambitions of becoming a big, you know, a institutional nonprofit, and to try to figure out how do we adapt to serve our community now. Mm. But this is what I think. So this is very much my personal opinion. If we're trying to teach kids how to use scientific thinking and we can't figure this shit out ourselves, then we are fucking failing. Yeah. So that was my biggest thing, is we have to figure this out. That's true. We cannot quit. We have to figure it out. If we're trying to teach kids that they can succeed in any career field, that they can go into science, one of the hardest fields, we have to show them that we can figure this out, that you can actually learn science at home, in your apartment, in your neighborhood, in your community. And we had to get the resources, and so we just did. We just figured it out.
That's wonderful. And look at all of the lives that are changed by this.
Yeah, I hope
Instead of doing whatever they would do, there's nothing wrong with video games. There's nothing wrong with drawing on the walls, whatever kids do. But I mean, think of a child who's never had a garden or knew about gardening.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly they learn about it and grow a garden of their own. I mean, that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, it was really amazing. And we, at first, it was really hard for us to get in contact with our school partners because they're out of school, and, you know, schools are caught up in trying to figure out this whole school year. And so I'm trying to find this balance of like reaching out and say, hey, we got the supplies, we want to give you these supplies, get them to your families, with also trying to be respectful that they need to figure out what their school year is going to look like. And so it felt like it was in the 13th hour that, you know, our three schools reached out and were like, do you have any more kids? And we were like, we do. And just to get them to the schools to know that they were then going to be able to distribute them. And some of the schools have decided that they're going to keep their kits for the whole school year and rotate them through their classes. And on top of the 560 kits we sent out, we also sent out, gave away bicycles and sent out digital cameras and binoculars and bird watching books. And we translated kits into Spanish and just all kinds of things. And so we knew that it's going to take a consolidated effort of us like reaching out to our partners, reaching out to families and saying, what do you need? And just giving them whatever they need. And so we called every single one of our families and interviewed them back in the spring and just like put together a plan, like, this is what we're hearing, what they need, and let's just get it out.
That's
there.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was really cool. Just
doing it all. Science and Secret Santa.
Yeah. Right now we have our last program of the summer running, and it's our newest program. I have to highlight, because I'm really proud of it. It's called Freedom Grown, and it's at our Children's Learning and Heritage Garden. And we brought back Preston Zimmerman, Mr. P, Uncle P, we call him. He's a Afro-veganist, herbalist, Black conscious, Southern, just amazing human being who worked with us as a camp guide a couple years ago, came back from South Carolina to work with our kids and to launch this program that's about teaching kids how to grow their own food from seed, to grow medicine, to know what plants are medicinal, and then to create that medicine and to learn how to heal your body from your food and be able to recognize in the grocery store like how to grow something and what it is and how to cook with it. And so the kids are doing mindfulness, they're doing meditation, they're doing yoga, they do libations, they learn how to connect with their ancestors. They've been making tinctures, they've been making sage and sage wands. They're going to be learning how to do canning, preserving food, fermenting food, growing it, and they get to spend the entire day outside. So they're in fourth through ninth grade, and it's a small group of them. So it's really focused on the Northeast Portland, North Portland, New Columbia community. Mm-hmm. But it's really bringing back that cultural knowledge. Like Black and Brown folks have always had a connection with the land. Mm-hmm. And it's through traumas and history that we've lost some of that. And so Freedom Grown is about
displacement through, you know, gentrification and what have you.
What, say that one
more time? Oh, I said a misplacement through mm-hmm. gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who knew that area were kicked out of that area, forced to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Especially in that particular area.
Especially in North and Northeast. Yeah, definitely. So that's what we're doing through the month of August. Our last program of the summer, it's our community responsive program. And I don't know what it's going to look like into September, mm-hmm. but we've got this children's garden, and we want to continue to bring families out there to teach kids about how to eat healthy, why it matters, and just about plants as medicine, like helping them understand, like, yes, there's pharmaceuticals. Yes, you can go pop a pill to solve just about anything. But you can also heal yourself just from choosing better food choices and knowing what to eat, and that there's cultural ties there. Like Black people eat a lot of healthy and good foods that are part of who we are, that we don't even recognize as being medicinal. So. We do. Some people do, but that's what it's about, teaching the kids.
There's healthy food that's medicinal, and then there's soul food that's medicinal.
Yes, and there's food that's both. And if it's feeding your soul and your body, that's ideal. And if it tastes good.
So, I just wanted to ask you how people could help you, how they could get involved. You know, what are the ways?
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, we'll do our five questions that we ask every podcast guest.
So, like I mentioned before, we're working on launching Future Science Leaders, which is a student-centered science curriculum. Will eventually be K-12, but we're going to start with third through eighth grade, and it will be both a curriculum that will be for year-round learning that will integrate outside learning, cultural perspectives, and Western science, and be rigorous, and also a professional development model. So we want to work with teachers to help support them in teaching from a DEI lens, from teaching and supporting students from a trauma-informed lens. So we're bringing all those things into Future Science Leaders. And it's a heavy lift for us as a small organization to get the resources we needed, like we need to start this project. In addition, like I mentioned, we did all of our programs for free this year, and it's not sustainable for the long run. And so we have different ways people can give through our website, through GoFundMes. We have a new program. We're merging with a community program called Your Street, Your Voice, which is a design, architectural design program with a social justice lens that has kids ask, high school students ask the question, what could you change in your neighborhood? What would you change and why? And going through a process, and they learn about gentrification and redlining and blight and all of these different things, but bringing in that. So we're merging with them. So it's a really big year for us this coming year. And we want to be able to continue to do our take-home kits. We want to expand our virtual camps to start serving communities outside of Portland, outside of Oregon, fingers crossed. And so we just need more resources, whether it's a $5 gift or $500. I'm reaching out, I'm doing house parties or planning to do house parties. If there's businesses that have corporate giving and would like, you know, have someone come in either in person or virtually do a presentation, we're doing that. And then we're just accepting resources too, like things that we can, like tangible things, like for take home kits. And so we have a list of like a wish list as well, and volunteers. So volunteer bus drivers or van drivers is a really big thing that we're going to need for next summer. So there's lots of ways that people can support. But I think aside from monetary gifts, if your listeners have a social media audience in the thousands or even in the hundreds and want to say and want to highlight us or say, hey, like, go to our page, like us, share information, we're trying to build up our following on social media too. So
yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah,
all of that sounds great. Yeah. And you know, house parties are fun as they are, but a house party for a social justice cause, I'm there.
Yes, I know, right? Yeah, just trying to do some mini fundraisers and figure it out. We will figure it out. It's going to be a tough year. I mean, all nonprofits are going to have a really tough year ahead. But I trust that the resources are out there and that everything we need, we're going to get connected. And so if there are folks who are listening who are identify as BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, person of color who works in a STEM field, you know, we recruit board members every year. We also look for guest educators to come in and teach and train our camp guides, and then to also work with our youth. So there's specific opportunities for Black and Brown folks as well that we're looking for. But we have a need for everything. So, so it's just a matter of plugging in,
well,
you know, to the right place.
You know, you're doing it. So
thank you.
And reach out and ask for all these things, because I know that, you know, we're willing to help, and tons of other people are willing to help.
Yes.
And that's one good thing you learn in these crazy, confusing times, because there's actually good people out there.
So many good people. And I think that's where I feel hopeful. I struggle with the hopefulness around ending racism, but I know for sure that there are good people of every ethnicity and race. And it's going to take all of us, like, just figuring things out and doing what we can and doing self-care and trying to find balance and going hard and protesting and tearing shit up. Like, all of that's important.
Well, you and Camp also are doing the work. So I appreciate that.
Thank
and I'm
you.
Sure that every child and every parent of those children also appreciate it.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so we're at our five questions. So these are the five questions we ask all our podcast guests.
Okay.
So the first one is, if you weren't doing this, what would you be doing? So whatever business or organization or job.
So my dream job, and I'm keep putting it out into existence because I want to manifest this for when it's time for me to move on from Elso. I really want to be Mark Wayans. He's a YouTuber that travels around the world and eats food and just like hangs out and gets to share stories of culture and people. And so I want to travel and connect with people and eat food and just see the world. So
I see that.
That's my dream. And
maybe,
that's what I would be doing.
Maybe on a Netflix special or something like that.
Yeah, or just like not. Just incognito.
You, just you eating.
Yes, just me eating and getting paid and maybe consulting. Like I feel like I've developed a lot of knowledge and experience in doing this work, and I want to be able to share it. I've been pulled towards Africa. I'm being pulled that way. So I'm hoping that somehow I find myself to West Africa in the future. So if anybody out there knows how to get me and my family to West Africa, we're still figuring out where, but I'm looking at Senegal and the Gambia and Ghana.
Nice.
But, you know, I think that's part of where I see myself is going that direction. And, you know, I've always thought of myself as a global citizen. But I think it's time for folks in the diaspora to start coming home and to think about Africa. And so that's what I've been doing. And so that's where I just think, like, maybe I could have a YouTube channel and just travel around the continent and build and consult. And
I mean, I believe you can do it all.
Yeah, I think so too. I fell into Elso. I was like, I got this idea. And 5 years later, so yeah.
And so if you could have some sort of celebrity or politician partner in camp also, who would that person be?
Michelle Obama, no doubt.
She's my answer. Oh. Michelle's my answer to everything.
To everything.
Someone will be like, who should we hire? Michelle Obama.
Michelle Obama.
Who do you want to hang out with?
Michelle Obama.
Who inspires you, Michelle?
Yes.
I don't know if you saw that convention speech last night.
I watched part of it. I need to go back and watch the rest of it, but she's just down to earth. Like, she is a real human. She's a mom, and she's so stinking smart and beautiful and just thoughtful and wise. I plan to apply for the Obama Foundation fellowship that they have. I've had my eye on it for a couple years now. I'm waiting to also get to a certain point because I don't want to have no. I don't think I can take a no answer. But I'm hoping that I can meet her one day and do something with her. I want to put something good out into the world with Michelle.
If you meet her, remember your lawyer.
I will. Definitely.
I think you're close to that.
I hope so. Yeah. I'm trying.
And then what about a squad? So if you were to have a group of people, either dead or alive, that kind of lift you up every day, who would those people be?
Oh, I already have my squad. My squad is solid. Kellyanne Richardson, our ELSO co-founder, Lindsay DeVeras, Tiana Wallace, Karima, Guillaume Plaisir, Preston Zimmerman. Those are my people. We work together, we play together, we travel together, we uplift one another. Of course, Jesse Brown, my spouse. I wouldn't be here doing this work if it wasn't for him encouraging me to take that leap of faith, to quit my day job, and to just believe in what we've created and what we're doing. So those are my people. There's other folks. I'm sure I forgot to name someone. I'm sorry if I didn't name you. Like, did I forget? Because I don't want somebody to hear this and be like, I thought
what
we were good
me?
Friends.
Yeah.
But those are some of the folks who are closest to me, who really help me be my best self and really want the best for me and for my family. And Jackson Brown and Nyra Brown, I work hard every day for those too, so...
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you have great people in your life. So
I have great
important.
People. Yeah. You have to. Everybody should have great people. Real relationships. Just a few good friends.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And tough love, too. We need that sometimes.
Definitely.
Right, Janita? I'm just kidding. Janita and I we go way back, and there's been some tough love conversations.
Yeah.
So what about your guilty pleasure purchase? So, like, if you, and I know it's not all about money. It's just a question we have right now. Mm-hmm. But, if you had money and you're like, okay, what do I do with this money?
Yeah.
What would you do?
I would rent. I love to search for houses, like to rent, like vacation rentals. That's like my favorite pastime, especially in COVID. It's like I could go to Mount Hood and stay here. I wonder if I could find a house with an indoor pool. Oh, so that's my guilty pleasure, and really nice red wine. I love wine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, we'll have to go drink wine sometime.
Oh,
maybe
please.
Syndicate Wine Bar or somewhere else. Yeah.
Yep. That'd be awesome.
I love that you said Mount Hood is beautiful, but I was thinking you would say like Greece or something like that.
There too. I'm just trying to be realistic. I'm like, I can't get there right now. We might get there and not be able to get back. But definitely, I love Mount Hood. Like, I have a special tie to Mount Hood. So.
Yeah, but born
and raised here in Portland. So
Mount Hood is beautiful.
Mm-hmm,
so, and then what about the last question is our shout out question. So who are, a couple organizations that are doing the thing that you're like, wow.
Yeah.
Who are you impressed with now? Who should people know about or look up?
ACTA Nonverba, which is out in down in Oakland, California. Awesome organization that I really respect and admire. The Black Food Sovereignty Coalition, Black Futures Farm, that's here locally in Oregon, and Mudbone Grown as well is another local Black-led farm program. The Blueprint Foundation, we happen to be partners with them, but they have just awesome leadership and great programs as well. And Center for Diversity in the Environment, CDE, and Keta Gonzalez, Gladys Ruiz. These are women of color who have been a key piece of my support system, who have elevated me and elevated ELSO and supported ELSO. And CDE has programs across the country. So if folks are interested in hiring an organization that can help come in and work with staff, work with folks to do some of the DEI work, CDE is the place to go. Awesome. Center for Diversity and the Environment.
Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
I love it.
And, you know, I hope you take time. You talked about self-care. I hope you take time to reflect on the work you're doing and how special it is. It's something. So keep up the hard
work.
Thank
you. I'm taking off. I took off Fridays for the month of August to just hang with my family. So we're going to go camping this weekend. And I'm going to figure out this school thing this year. I think it's going to be, I'm up for the challenge. I'm one of those people that I like a challenge, and I believe you have to go through the fire to come out and to really be stronger. And so, but I feel for all of the parents out there, and I just show so much love and respect for all the teachers, because this is a lot to ask of them to do and to shift and do. And so, especially the families of teachers, my good friend Tiana Wallace that I mentioned, she's a teacher, a classroom educator back in Boston, and just knowing what they have to plan for and prepare and endure, especially if you work with student bodies that have, or school communities that don't have as much resources. I'm blessed to be a part of a school community that has a lot of resources, but I know that's not the norm. And so I want to put that out there, that teachers, we see you, we hear you, and we know, like, teachers need support. So if you don't support ELSO, go support some teachers.
I am 100% there with you. I think teachers are amazing. They need everything that we can give them.
Yes.
Whether that's fair pay, supplies, patience, following rules.
Yes. Take your kid to wear the mask. Put a mask on. Everybody should wear a mask.
Yes. Everyone should wear a mask. Wash your hands. Sanitize. These are easy things.
Easy things. Just take care of your body.
These are not stealing your liberty. These are easy things.
Good for all of us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
We want to thank Sprinivasa Brown of Camp ELSO for being our special guest on this episode. Camp ELSO provides culturally relevant science and environmental education. Find out more at campelso.org. Thanks again to our sponsor, Iron Tap Station, which is now providing delivery of a limited number of ciders and beers, as well as all cans by Cafe Go. Cafe Go is a new local food cart and taproom delivery service. Or just stop by Iron Tap Station on Miser Mondays for $1 off pints and $2 off Crowlers, which is a 2-pint of any beer on the tap list in a 32-ounce can, and Growler fills for just $14. Iron Tap Station, 33 taps, nothing but craft. Check out irontapstation.com or find them on social media at irontap_Beaverton. Again, we want to extend a sincere thank you to X-Ray FM for the 2020 X-Ray Award. Check out all the good work they're doing at 91.1 FM, 107.1 FM, and online at xray.fm. And thank you for checking out this episode of All of Your Business. You can visit us at allofyourbusinesspodcast.com for previous episodes, sponsors, and much more. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast and share with your friends. All of Your Business Podcast is edited at Track 11 Music in downtown Portland, Oregon.